This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. Today on the Radio Cafe, we're talking about the New Mexico Land Conservancy, an organization that is having its annual event, Corazón de la Tierra, on Saturday the 3rd of October at 4 o'clock at the Pachesky Conservation Center here in Santa Fe. This year, they're going to be celebrating nearly 150,000 acres of land permanently conserved, and they'll be honoring Wagon Mound rancher and natural resource manager Greg Moore. I'd like to welcome to the Radio Cafe Beth Mills. She's conservation director at the New Mexico Land Conservancy. She has a long background in planning and conservation. Welcome.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
And I'd like to welcome, joining us by phone, Sid Goodlow. He's been owner and operator of the Carrizo Valley Ranch near Capitan, New Mexico. He founded the Southern Rockies Agricultural Land Trust, and he's now an advisor to the New Mexico Land Conservancy. He's a board member of the Quivira Coalition and the New Mexico Cattle Growers Association. He's an international livestock consultant. He's worked all over the world. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So, Beth, tell us about the work of the New Mexico Land Conservancy.
Yeah, sure. We're a statewide land trust, so we work all over New Mexico, and we work with private landowners to protect the land that they love and are concerned about. We work primarily with farmers and ranchers, as it turns out, mostly in the northeast and southwest part of the state. And we work with a mechanism called the conservation easement, which could be better phrased as a conservation agreement that protects their land into the future, mostly from subdivision, and protects the conservation values there, including wildlife and open space, and the agricultural values. So currently we hold 65 easements across the state, and as you mentioned, are protecting a total of about 150,000 acres.
So conservation easement, I mean, when people say easement, they think of, you know, something a little bit different. This is its own special concept, and that is an agreement where landowners agree to conserve their land, but that doesn't mean that they don't live there or that they don't work there. These are often working ranches and farms, agricultural land, and the idea is that you don't subdivide and develop it, and thereby you keep, well, natural resources, habitat, wildlife corridors, things like that.
Correct. Absolutely. Yeah, the landowner retains all the private property rights that they have that are associated with their land. We just work with them through a legal agreement to make sure that the land is not fragmented or subdivided in the future, and help them in any way to bring resources to the management work they're already doing.
And there are tax advantages.
Absolutely. Many landowners enter into these agreements because there are significant tax advantages at both the state and federal level for doing this.
Now, how do you choose what land to protect, or probably more accurately, how did the owners of this land choose you?
Yeah, I think the latter is more accurate. People come to us, it's a voluntary agreement, and they hear about us through their neighbors, through venues like this, and they come to us and tell us what their vision is for the land, and we see if our work can coincide with their vision and help them achieve that. Sometimes landowners find that this isn't exactly the right fit, but for those who particularly want to maintain a working landscape, like a ranch, and are looking for some financial support in doing so, find this to be a good arrangement for them.
We're talking about private land in a state which has a vast amount of public land. What is the relationship between conservation on private land of the kind you're talking about and the public land that is often nearby or actually adjacent?
Yeah, there's a close relationship, and maybe a little later, if Sid wants to speak to this, he may have an opinion as well. But many of our ranchers also lease public land that's adjacent to them. And like in anything, there are people who are good at what they do and people who are not so good at what they do. But the folks that we work with generally are also managing the public land that they're leasing in a similar manner to their own private property.
Are they allowed to do that by the public entities that actually own it, that they lease from?
Yes, particularly in the case of state land. I can't speak as clearly to the federal policies, but I know that our ranchers can receive help from the Natural Resources Conservation Service to do work on state land that they're leasing, and that often is stewardship and conservation work on that land.
Now, once a piece of land is under conservation easement, does the New Mexico Land Conservancy have anything to say about how it's managed, or does your role then end?
Our role doesn't absolutely end, although we certainly defer to the landowner in terms of the way they're managing, but we see ourselves as a resource to them to help them network with other land managers and gain ideas about good best practices and good practices. Basically, what our role is to make sure that they are in compliance with the language of the agreement that we set up with them. But further, we like to think that we have a stewardship role and a responsibility to be in conversation with the landowner to understand how they are managing and offer help if they seek it.
Let's turn to Sid Goodloe. You have been ranching for 55 years and bring a great deal of knowledge and education to what you're doing. And one of the things that I find so fascinating is that when you bought the piece of land that you now have and that you've been working for all of these years and that you've restored, it was really degraded. What was the land like, and how did you have the eyes to see or learn to see what that land should be like, and then restore it to that condition?
Well, it was really quite a bit of luck involved, I think. I found this property because it was so degraded. It was for sale at a very cheap price, and that's the only way I could get in the ranching business. So I looked at it with the eyes of inexperience, and yet I could see that it had good soil, it had a lot of potential, but it was overgrown with pinon and juniper and ponderosa to the point that there was very little grass available, and what grass was available had been grazed off for probably over 100 years by sheep and cattle and homesteaders that lived here, that had horses, mules, goats, and all that stuff. So the land was so degraded that it was not producing, and it had the potential to produce. I worked with the Soil Conservation Service, as it was called then, and figured out what I had to do to bring it back into production. So they started me out, and a lot of this, I guess you'd call it land improvement that I've done here, has just been done by trial and error, and taking advantage of the things that I've done that weren't mistakes, and not making the same mistake twice. So we've got it now to a highly functioning watershed that not only benefits the people that are on the that own it or using the property, but it benefits the people downstream in the watershed, like in Roswell, for instance. We are making more moisture, more water available for the aquifers that supply Roswell by getting rid of the water-hungry invading trees.
What was the natural ecosystem of that land before it was degraded? I mean, you've talked about, and a lot of people have talked about, how the first sort of white folks who came west treated land in the west as if it were land in the east, which of course it isn't. It's a lot more arid. What was the ecosystem like before all that happened?
Yeah, very good question. These ecosystems here are, I guess you'd call them foothills rather than the plains like you find out east of Roswell, or the higher mountain areas that you'd find around Santa Fe. This was an open savanna. It was scattered large trees with grass growing on 95-98% of the land. So there was very little erosion, if any. There was great production of the food that herbivores eat, which were elk, deer, all the other things that lived here, antelope and so forth, that were here before Anglo settlement. So the way that was maintained was by periodic fire. The Fire Research Institute at the University of Arizona has done great research in finding what sort of ecosystems we had back 200 years ago, and they've come up by counting tree rings and seasons and so forth. They've come up with the figure of about every 7 years this country burned off and kept the population of these water-hungry plants down. As you know, everything has a predator, and the predator for these plants that are now occupying our forests and rangelands, the predator was fire, and it is now gone. So unless it's a wildfire, and we don't want that if we can help it, but fire is the key ingredient that kept this area in very productive condition.
So without fire, it's hard to, particularly for a private landowner, reintroduce fire and have controlled burns, because, as I understand it, if you haven't had natural fire happening every 7 years, there's a lot of extra fuel for that fire, and it's hard to control. How do you deal with that? What do you do?
You're very well informed, young lady. That's a very good point. Actually, it's a little easier to do prescribed burning on private property than it is on public, because so many people have built homes in fire-prone areas that are adjoining the public lands that it is very difficult to do a prescribed burn now. Plus the fact, as you mentioned, that the fuel has built up over the last 150, 200 years to the point that any fire that you set now on the public lands is a dangerous fire, unless you're really prepared by putting your time and money into your black lines to protect adjoining property from being burned by a fire that could get away without those black lines. So a great deal of preparation to do any prescribed burn is required on private as well as public land, and private landowners don't have the firefighting equipment to do this. So what we need is a cooperative agreement between the public land managers at state, federal, BLM, forest, and those entities, working with the private landowners to do prescribed burns, because they have the equipment that is a lot of the time is not used for several months. It's just sitting there, and it could be used to assist a private landowner that is adjoining the public lands to do a prescribed burn. But for some reason, that hasn't been able. I haven't been able to get that done. I've tried, but I haven't been able to get it done yet. But we'll keep trying.
Do you use fire on your own land?
Oh yes, we use fire here. You bet. We're very, very, very careful about how we use it, because it's so dangerous to start a prescribed burn without extra equipment that the public land agencies have. So that's why we would like to do some cooperative burning with them. But our fires are only to improve the condition of the rangeland. That is, a fire will take care of a lot of the seedlings that would lead into a solid canopy someday, like we've got now on a lot of our public lands. And we also, by cycling the matter that grows on there, the herbaceous growth, we put fertilizer back into the soil. You know, in this particular climate, decomposition does not occur very rapidly, if at all. And we need to recycle those minerals and nutrients that are in these plants, both the grass and the trees and brush. We need to recycle those into the soil, and fire is really about the only way you can do it in an arid climate because the decomposition is so very slow.
Very interesting. We're talking to rancher Sid Goodlow. Now, you started doing something that's called rotational grazing. What does that mean, and what is the rationale for it?
Well, I guess the best way to put it simply is it mimics the buffalo. You concentrate the cattle in an area for a short period of time and move them and give that particular spot an ample rest to replenish the root reserves and make a seed crop if possible, if you get the rain. So rotational grazing or planned grazing, or it's now called holistic planned grazing, came from Rhodesia back in the 60s. And Alan Savory has spread the word throughout the whole world, and more people are using rotational grazing, which is the opposite of year-long grazing that occurred when the first settlers came to New Mexico. They didn't realize the importance of moving the animals. They just put them in a pasture and let them stay there the year round. So they kept going back to the more palatable plants over and over until they killed them. And so when you start rotational grazing like I have here, we started it in 1971. I brought the idea from Alan Savory in Rhodesia back in the late 60s and put it into practice here on Carrizo Valley Ranch in 1971. And the biodiversity that we have now doesn't compare at all with what was here before. This was basically a monoculture of blue gramma grass and trees and shrubs. And now we have many different kinds of grasses and forbs that furnish grazing pretty much the year round, except when it's covered with snow. So rotational grazing has pretty well taken at least the western United States, where I'm familiar, and most of the progressive ranchers that think about it now because of what Alan Savory presented to us and made us think about the grass instead of just believing it was there to graze. Now we think about the health of the grass and the health of the ecosystem. So rotational grazing is now a common practice, at least here in the Southwest.
So you've got your cows in one pasture, and then after a certain amount of time, which is, I think, pretty scientifically arrived at, you move them to another pasture and let that first pasture rest. How does the, I mean, we're in a still quite an arid environment. There's not a whole lot of grass in the first place compared to rainy climates. Do you have to do rotational grazing differently here than you would in a wetter area?
I do. I rotate from about the 1st of May till, the 1st of December, and that completely encompasses the grazing, the growing season. And through the winter months, I rotate, but I don't rotate as rapidly. And I use different pastures for instance, we'll have one herd of heifers and one herd of cows and then some bulls. And so I move them around without a planned grazing program that holds true year after year. I don't do that much in the wintertime. I don't worry about rotating in the wintertime. When it does the most good is during the growing season, which in New Mexico is from May to November. And take East Texas, for instance, they've got three or four more months of growing season, so they can rotate in a pattern for a longer period of time. And it's certainly nothing wrong with rotating in the dormant season. I just don't see it being a real necessary thing, because I try to concentrate on the fact that the cows are calving and they need special attention. So I kind of focus on that rather than the grazing during the dormant season.
Now, were there buffalo at one point in the area where you are?
Well, there's been some buffalo bones found here, so I guess there were, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, because I'm asking because it's just such an interesting and massive project to try to restore an ecosystem back to its natural state. Do you feel like you've been able to do that? Is it close to the way it might have been a few hundred years ago now where you are?
Thanks for the question, Mary Charlotte. That's a very good one. Yes, and the last year, actually 13 months, the last 13 months have been the best I've seen here in a half century. And to see the land respond when you get good rains at the right time, like we've had in the last year, to see that is very gratifying. And I was just out this morning looking around and doing some herbicide work on salt cedar, and I just can't believe the vegetation we've got this year. It just, the land has been rehabilitated to the point that it can really utilize the rainfall that we've had this year, and the production is just fantastic.
As you said, it's one thing to do the work on your land, and you've got quite a lot of land, but you are in an ecosystem and in a watershed that's much bigger than your ranch. Are your neighbors doing similar things? Like you said that your work positively affects the watershed of the people around you. How does what other people are doing affect you?
Another good question. My neighbors that have private land like I do are doing exactly what I'm doing. It took them a while to figure it out. They thought I was some kind of a nut when I started this, but they've started doing the same thing, and it's responding just as well. They're doing a very good job, and again, the NRCS has been a great help to get this done. So that part of it is responding. Now, the public land, which is on three sides of this ranch, has only done a little work, and most of the areas in New Mexico, they've done very little of this thinning and all. That's why we're having all these wildfires, and the watersheds are not productive like they were back 150 years ago. So what's happening is, for instance, this ranch, the springs were completely dry when I got here. And, of course, we've done some watershed work here that have directly affected our springs, and they've come back. But the majority of the watershed that I'm in is under Forest Service management. And although they have begun to do some thinning and land renewal, they haven't really done a lot. So we don't have the wells and the springs that we should have, and it's simply because there are too many trees on the national forest, and until we get a wildfire to wipe them out, and that, of course, results in problems, the erosion and all, but until we get that area thinned, we're not going to have the watershed production that we should have, and neither will places like Roswell, which are down the aquifer from here. So I guess my point there is, those of you that live in the city should pressure the public land managers to do some more land renewal and thin these trees out and get the water back in the aquifer.
I think it's such an interesting point, because a lot of people don't, and I'm just really coming to understand the mechanics by which this works. If you're not observing these natural processes, you think, okay, there's a certain amount of water in the ground, there's a certain amount of water in the surface, and there's a certain amount of rainfall, and that's the water you got. You take it in, take it out. But in fact, the land, the trees, the forests are the determinants of how much of the water that falls from the sky goes back into the natural system, into the springs, into the aquifers, into the wells. What determines whether the land takes that water, and what gets in the way?
You nailed another one. People need to understand that, for instance, the regular-sized juniper tree, for instance, say it's 6 to 8 inches in diameter, will use 17 gallons of water a day year-round. 100 six-inch junipers to the acre will use 9 inches of precipitation per year. That's half of, or more than half of what we get. So if people understand that, plus when it snows and the snow lands in the trees where they've got a pretty solid canopy, the dry wind comes after the storm and evaporates that snow before it ever even touches the ground, and that is spared and does get to the ground. The trees suck it up, and it doesn't go in the aquifer. So because of the excessive number of trees that we have in our national forest in New Mexico, the aquifers are robbed of a large portion of the water that should be there.
And it's counterintuitive, I think, to a lot of people, because you think, well, trees are good. Trees photosynthesize. Trees are natural. But it's that element of fire, which is the X factor that you may not think about, that a lot of those small trees that thicken the forest wouldn't even be there if we had fire.
Right. That's correct. But, you know, they do photosynthesize, sure. But if you look under these pinon juniper thickets, the ground is bare. And there's no photosynthesis coming from bare ground. So it's the trees that are doing it, and the amount of photosynthesis done by a conifer compared to the grass that would be growing there is I don't know the figures, but I'm sure it's a lot less. So if you remove the trees and you get a good stand of herbaceous growth after you do the removal, then the photosynthesis is still there.
Let's talk for a moment about another piece of the balance of nature in a state like New Mexico, or in New Mexico, and that is that there are so many creatures native to this landscape, at least without people around, from the smallest bugs to the biggest mammals and both predators and herbivores, and they naturally at one point kept each other in check. Now we have ranches, we have towns, we have roads, we've got populations of people. Things get way out of balance. What does this look like from your perspective on your ranch in Lincoln County?
Well, we've, for instance, on the lower end of the ranch where we had a lot of one-seed juniper, we've taken that out pretty well, and the antelope have come back. Up here on the upper end of the ranch, we now have a lot of elk that we didn't have before because we've improved the habitat. In fact, the New Mexico Department of Fish, of Game and Fish, have awarded me a trophy hunt in December because of the habitat work I've done. They realized that the population of the animals that they are responsible for, the game animals, that population is directly dependent on habitat. And now they've realized that, and they've started to give an incentive to private landowners that do the improvement of the habitat that the game animals like. So that's where we are here. We've got the right habitat, and of course, we have a problem with predators. We're trying to keep a reasonable control of coyotes. We have a a bear and lion problem here. The lions get the older bucks, and the bear get the elk calves, and the cows get the fawns. So if you get an excessive number of those predators, then you lose your population of wildlife. So we try to keep that in balance. And that, as far as your question is concerned, what do we do about it? Well, that's what we do. We try to improve the habitat and keep the predator balance correct.
Another thing that I find fascinating, kind of encouraging, about the kind of conservation-oriented ranching that you're doing is that when you take that ecosystem-based environmentalist approach to the land, you actually do better economically, or a lot of people do. What does that look like for you?
Well, I'm amazed at the things you know about this business. You're way up on the scale of asking the right questions. Yes, I am an environmentally sensitive rancher. I'm not a greenie. I'm not a tree hugger. I'm just an environmentally sensitive rancher because that makes me money. And it's just that simple. And there's an aesthetic factor also. You know, when you see what you've done and see that it benefits the wildlife and it's aesthetically pleasing and it helps the watershed, then that's a good feeling.
Now, all the knowledge that you've taken really your entire life to bring together, and you've made this ranch that is economically viable, that's beautiful, that contributes to the environment around it, how do you pass that knowledge on? Talk about the transmission from one generation to another, because, I mean, ranching is traditionally a multi-generational kind of activity, although it isn't always, because sometimes people leave the ranch and they don't want to have anything to do with it. What's your perspective on that?
Well, that's the subject of your program. A conservation easement or agreement is the way to handle that, and that's what we've done. Number one, I developed this ranch out of I guess you could call it the wilderness or the overused era, into a productive piece of property. And I don't want it turned into a subdivision. I want my children to be able to raise their children in a rural environment, and my grandchildren the same, and the great-grandchildren. Raising a child in a rural environment is the best thing you can do for a young person. So that's the purpose behind my multi-generational approach, and that is to put a conservation agreement on this property. It'll always be a ranch. And besides, the advantage of when I die, my kids couldn't pay the death tax or inheritance tax without selling a part of the ranch. So that's protected also. So there's two things. My heirs can raise a child in a rural environment, and my immediate heirs don't have to sell part of the property to pay the inheritance tax.
So we are talking about, and we're getting back now to, the New Mexico Land Conservancy's work, and they're having this event on the 3rd of October to honor the work of rancher Greg Moore. Tell us about him and about his work. He was not able to come to the cafe today, but I guess you've worked closely with him?
Well, I live a long way from Greg, but we're still very close friends. And, you know, if two guys both went to Texas A&M, they're good friends for life, and that's kind of the way Greg and I are. He came down here to look at this place when I had a tour and saw what we were doing and thought it was a good thing. And although he came from the Gulf Coast and his father had died and he had to take that ranch over at Wagon Mound, he was open-minded, receptive to land improvement procedures that many older ranchers weren't interested in. So Greg was able to absorb that sort of thing and went back and put it into effect, especially Bernie. And Greg's got an area that's much, much easier to burn than I do. He's got some canyons and canyon walls that he can use for fire lines that I don't have here. I've got a barbed wire fence between me and the Forest Service, and if fire gets across that fence, I'm in big trouble. So I do have a problem. And he is effectively using fire to cut down the population of these water-hungry plants that we've been talking about. So between that and he is now established, I think, 7 what he calls game sanctuaries, which are fenced off the same, I guess, as I've fenced my riparian zones off to preserve the vegetation that grows there for the wildlife. And he's increased the population of deer and elk and antelope tremendously on that property. And he does rotational grazing, not the way I do it exactly, but he does it. And his observation is very interesting that he made of that area that he's in. He noticed that land was grazed from 1st of May till the middle of October, 1st of November, every year in the same place. And it developed this monoculture of grama grass that can withstand heavy grazing and gets pretty well sod-bound, and there's not a great deal of biodiversity. If you bring in yearlings from Texas, for instance, and put them there the 1st of May, middle of April, and leave them there till the middle of October, and stock it heavily enough that you come out of it with some money, I guess, but it's not good for the land. And he has incorporated a cow-calf operation with a yearling operation where he can give some of his pastures rest during the growing season that they didn't get before he took over. So he's learned a lot about rotational grazing and about fire, and he's put them into practice. He's got a quite a large property that he can do all that on, and he's established these game sanctuaries and developed water. I don't know how many new waterings he's put in just in the last couple of years. He's working with the Natural Resources Conservation Service to do all that. They've been a great help to him, and he's getting that property into a sure enough show place for people that want to know how to be an environmentally sensitive rancher. That's what Greg has done.
What are your hopes, Sid, for the state of New Mexico? Do you see, I mean, you said there's more and more people doing this. There's also some old-timers that haven't really made those kinds of changes. Do we have the population of young people in this field or going into this field and really conserving the land?
No. That's another wonderful question. What's happened is in the last 2 years, the cattle prices have doubled. We're way down in our numbers. The demand is strong, so it's a supply and demand situation. Without the supply, the demand is significant to cause an increase in prices. So what's happened, you ask about young people coming back to the ranch and putting in these progressive moves and environmentally sensitive moves, these young people, instead of thinking about, you know, a job in town somewhere or whatever, anything but going back to the ranch because dad's driving that old 1968 pickup that's about to fall apart, the fences aren't too good, the corrals are in pretty bad shape, and now all of a sudden in the last 2 or 3 years, they're saying, oh, dad's got him a brand new Silverado. He's got a crew out here fixing fence and building the corrals back. And by golly, I believe I'll just come back and be a partner with him on the ranch. That's what's happening, and it's a good thing. And the ranchers that are making more money than they have been, thank goodness, finally, we're beginning to improve on the break-even deal. We're making a little money, and we can put that money back into the land and do the conservation practices that need to be done. So the ranching industry is on the threshold of improving the land and bringing the young folks back to the ranch.
Sid Goodlow, I want to thank you so much for spending all this time with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's my pleasure, and I'm really impressed with your knowledge of what's going on, and I would like to invite you to come to Carrizo Valley Ranch and have a look at all the things that you've learned some way and kind of see how they're put into practice.
Well, thank you. I will definitely take you up on that because I think it's just really important for, you know, people who are, if you can call Santa Feans urban people, because it's not the world's most urban environment compared to a really big city, but we can talk about these and things and we can think about them, but then to really see them in real life. And I think the point you made about aesthetics is really kind of profound, because there's a way that you, on some level, you know you're doing the right thing when you see this beauty growing up around you.
Oh, it is really impressive right now. I'll tell you, it is so beautiful now to see this country respond to a good year, and I'm just so thankful that God let me live long enough to see it.
Well, Sid, thank you once again for being with us.
You're very welcome, and I hope to see you soon.
Excellent. Now let's go back to Beth Mills, who has been sitting here very quietly, from the New Mexico Land Conservancy. Sid is one great example of land that is in conservation agreement, conservation easement. There's also another nearly 150,000 acres in the state of New Mexico. You have a much bigger goal than that as an organization, to put way more land into conservation easement.
Yeah, we do. We have a huge long-term goal to, I can't even remember the goal that our ED has set for us.
Isn't
but
it
it's
a million acres?
It's some enormous amount of acres by 2030, I believe it is. So working with people like Sid, and our land trust holds the conservation easement on Sid's property, and we also hold the easement on Greg Moore's. And Greg Moore's ranch is 23,000 acres. And he was able to work with us in three phases. First donate, and then work with NRCS again to help purchase the remaining, the easement for the remaining acres. And I just wanted to circle back a little bit to something that Sid was talking about in terms of bringing the youth back to the land. And one thing that a conservation easement can do, in addition to reducing the death tax that he was talking about, which is important, is it makes the land affordable, much more affordable. Because once the easement's in place, the price of the land per acre comes way down.
It drops the value of the land because you can't put housing developments on it.
Right. So oftentimes that's the break point where it actually makes it available to younger people who are just starting out.
Very interesting.
So that it's helpful in that regard as well.
I would like to say it's when we put value on things, it's a funny thing because there's a value for a house, but there's not a value for an ecosystem.
Right.
And so when you say the value drops, that's only in economic terms, but in bigger terms like watershed health and things that actually keep us all going, the value might be much greater.
Yeah.
It might be even much greater economically if you did the math.
Yeah, it's a great observation. Perhaps sadly the system within which we're working, that these agreements are the real estate agreements, and we work within the land of appraisal, and you know, but your observation is absolutely correct. And I've often thought the same thing when I go out and look at a landscape, you know, trying to put a dollar value on what I'm seeing and the conservation values that are there. Those two systems don't often work in sync with each other.
Right.
But we're going to be honoring the work that Sid and specifically Greg Moore have been doing at our event on October 3rd, and we're going to be celebrating him and Greg Moore's work, and we're going to have food and music and a real party. We're going to have bluegrass band, Higher Ground, and it's a real wonderful annual get-together for us because, you know, our landowners are from all over the state, and so it's a chance for us to all celebrate together and to share ideas and, exchange information as well.
Now, if somebody's listening to this program and they have some land and they'd like to put it into a conservation agreement or conservation easement, are there any limitations on that? I mean, does it have to be in the thousands of acres or the hundreds, or what is it? What are the rules?
Well, it has to. There aren't really any rules, but we typically look for land that has high conservation value to it. So that's the primary thing.
So the vacant lot beside the old gas
right,
station, maybe not.
Yeah, we probably aren't so anxious to talk to those folks. But the acreage can be small, particularly if it's irrigated farmland. We've worked a lot with farmland in Corrales, where the pressure on residential development so close to Albuquerque is so high, and the zoning allows them to go down to one house per acre. And so we've worked with farmers who want to keep their land in agricultural production so close to the city to conserve as small as, 2 to 5 acres of land that's irrigated and highly productive. So in those cases, the agricultural values are really high, but the land area is quite small. On the other end of the spectrum is a place like Greg's Ranch, which is 23,000 acres in size, and everything in between. But really, it really comes down to the conservation value of the land itself.
So there are interesting tax breaks that people can get, and there's a complexity to it that we don't need to go into here, but that is potentially very beneficial for landowners. It's just about time to go, but I want to remind people that what we're talking about in the first place is an actual event that is happening on Saturday, October 3rd at 4 o'clock at the Pachesky Conservation Center on Richards Avenue. There's going to be drinks and dinner, and people will be speaking and dancing and music with Higher Ground Bluegrass Band. There will be an opportunity to win a weekend fly fishing excursion to the Trout Stalker Ranch near Chama, and there will be a ceremony honoring natural resource manager and rancher Greg Moore from Wagon Mound. Now, is there anything else that you want to let people know about, or that we can tell people before we go?
Just that if you are interested in a ticket to the event and attending the event, you can contact us at the New Mexico Land Conservancy. The website is nmlandconservancy.org. Our phone number out there is 505-986-3801. Or you can email Elizabeth Temple at ETEMPLE@nmlandconservancy.org.
Beth Mills is the Conservation Director of the New Mexico Land Conservancy. I want to thank you both. Sid Goodlatte. Sid, are you still on the phone?
I'm still here. I have one little comment.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
We're going to have a speaker at this meeting that Beth's been telling you about. His name is Dr. Larry Butler. He has a program on the RFD channel called Out on the Land, that comes on Tuesday at 5, I believe, here in New Mexico. And he goes around and does just what we've been talking about. He visits with ranchers and learns about conservation and conveys that to his audience.
Excellent. Good. Well, Sid and Beth, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
You're very welcome. It's a privilege.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to Studio X for their technical support and web design.